Our speakers today are David Staley from Ohio State and Patrick Masson and Ken Udis from UMass, and they're going to talk about agile organizations. Take it away.
Thank you very much. I'm the one on the left there, in case you didn't know. Just real quickly, how many folks here are familiar with agile software development? That's quite a... I've been giving the same spiel for years, and it's nice to see the hands going up. So the idea for us, what we'll be talking about, is can we take the principles and practices associated with agile software development and extend them to the larger, perhaps not only IT, but the university? And it's building on some of the work around agile project management that Jim Highsmith and the folks who created the Agile Manifesto, and of course you have to have a manifesto if you have any sort of movement. And the idea is that development, and whether that's projects and what David and Ken will talk about is academic programs, whatever the initiative might be, is the ability to develop at the same pace that your users or the folks that are engaged with that initiative can articulate their needs. And the idea is that neither the folks developing whatever that initiative is and the folks using that initiative know exactly what they want and how things are going to work. And so the goal is to create an environment that allows you to continually assess how things are working, what the issues are, and react to those quickly, hence Agile. And it's sort of a design through discovery process. And so there's a variety of texts out there I've just shown too, talking about agile software development. And I think the key point here is emphasis between traditional methods and agile methods is planning versus practice or process. And so you can think of the diagram on the left as, step on my power cord, as sort of the traditional planning process, right? The idea is that we're going to be able to forecast exactly all the effects that are going to happen during a implementation of a technology or the development of a new system or a new academic program. But in reality, I was going to use the stamp, the big game, Stanford and Cal, but I was afraid a riot would break out, or maybe the Doug Flutie and the Hail Mary. But so I tried to go pro level here. So. But the idea is that it's not that we don't plan, but it's more important to instill in the folks we work with and a set of principles and practices that allow us to adjust. So obviously, in this example, no one drew this diagram, this play, right? But the idea is that all the players had the ability, the fundamental skills that allow them to react in a way, except for the defense, which if you notice, actually Warren raises his hand before the play's over. Right, so he, and not to pick on him, but he, as the free safety, should have known that the play was still going, and perhaps if he had those same principles and practice that he would have been there. So that's sort of the concept, is that you want to instill in your organization these principles, and I'm going to talk about the principles that allow you to become agile and yes, react rather than plan and rather than create a strategy and point to a direction and so on. So a while back, we developed what we call an agile maturity model, and it's sort of around causality. And you can see, and we'll touch on this a bit more, but this just sets sort of the foundation. The values, principles, and objectives are what we sort of organize around agility and how to achieve an agile organization. And the practices are just sort of the tools that we use that invoke or that require these principles in order to create an agile organization. So the first one is emergence. And I think the idea around emergence is to, rather than have sort of a top-down initiative, a set of directives, is how well can an organization look out into its, among its stakeholders, and whether that's IT users or faculty or whoever it might be, and how can we capture the activities that are happening out there already and identify those that warrant further investment and development. An example of that is is there anyone from UC Irvine here? Okay, so this was brought up by Larry Wall, the developer of Perl, and he uses this example. And I went out on Google and tried to find the actual photographs to see if this is true. And he proposed as an example of emergence how the sidewalks were developed in the quad at UC Irvine. And I've never actually met anyone who knows if this is true or not. But if you look at this first picture, is an archival picture that I found. And anyone from Orange County knows there's no much, this open land is not available anymore. So you know this is an old picture, right? There's no open space like this. So zooming in, you can see the same picture zoomed in, that the story is that when they built the quad here, they didn't put any sidewalks in, and they let the folks walk between buildings, between classes. And wherever folks, the paths emerged, is that's where they would pave. And if you look at a Google image of today, you can see that the images, the paths that are there, line up pretty well with that. So the idea is that we're going to use the collective activity of whoever our stakeholders are, whatever the organization we're working with is, and use that as evidence for our decision making, rather than planning ahead for the sidewalks. Another concept within the Agile principles is incremental and iterative development. And the idea here is that incremental development is the slow extension of new services. And the idea is to make these extensions as small as possible so that there's little risk if that particular idea happens to fail. You get really detailed feedback because the only thing you've changed to the system is this one part. So if you notice that the system has, or the use of the system has changed, you can attribute that to the small incremental development that you've done. Iteration is the ability to go back over what you've done and reiterate that. And you learn from their previous practices and attempts at deployment or whatever it might be, and you've gone back and said, okay, can we do this better? So each iteration is an opportunity to enhance your practice, enhance your development processes, whatever it might be. And this is from Alistair Cockburn, who's also a manifesto signer. And I found this example from a book from the 1800s, 1882. And for those of you who are coming across the prairie and wanted to homestead, this book offered some tips for you. And the first one was when you're first out in the prairie and you're a young farmer and you don't have a wife or family yet, and resources might be scarce, and whatever you invest in you want to have last a while because you don't have the ability to swap everything out and rebuild everything, they offer a blueprint or a plan for incrementally and iteratively developing your house. So you start off here with the first example. It's just a single room, and they did make sure to tell you to put up a veranda because, you know, only everyone needed a veranda to show that you're a gentleman and your proper social standing. But then after that, you could take that same construction and you could add three rooms. And if you were married, you could perhaps add a bedroom, perhaps a pantry. There's a woodshed in the back. And then you can see in the final example that they've extended that to now that you have kids and perhaps you've been more established. And I think the quote here talks about anyone who's can, you know, I think it's you'll definitely be able to improve your standing because of the crops that you'll bring in, and you'll be able to extend your house here. But the idea is that you've incrementally built out your house based on your needs, and probably your building techniques and the ability to construct your house, your skill has increased each time you've added on something, right? So you've learned through the iteration process on building a house. And so I talked a little bit about that incremental iterative development allows for continuous and rapid feedback. Again, the idea that you can deploy something quickly and small enough that you can allow people to respond to that and shift or change in what you've deployed in a way that will allow you to address any issues. And again, that's going to be a small investment, and you're going to have a lower risk rather than trying to rebuild everything, start everything over again. So the example is sort of building a pyramid here. So the traditional way of building a pyramid, right, you have a first layer, or however high you want your pyramid, right? And you sort of stack these things on top of each other. You don't really have a working product until the pyramid's completed. So the idea between with incremental and iterative development, as well as responding to the needs at the same time users can articulate them is you might build a pyramid, and I've always got a pyramid. And if this satisfies my needs, fine, I'm done. But if one day it says, oh, well, we need to add more, and you can keep building this pyramid, the pyramid is always providing value. You're always able to get feedback on whether or not you need a bigger pyramid, and so on, until you go on, and you can build the biggest pyramid ever, I guess. The next principle we'll talk about is self-organization. And self-organization has two sides. There's the ability of an organization that allows individuals independently to come together around a particular project or area of interest. So you have this collective group of folks who identify through personal or professional reasons some affinity for this particular initiative, and they come together and organize around that. Once that group is organized, the other side of self-organizing groups is that they actually, the roles and responsibilities that they take up in that group are defined by the group. Right? So we don't have a top-down, because I'm the director of this department or because I'm the CIO, I'll pick together this committee, and the committee's got to be representative of these folks. The organization allows for individuals to find and join any group that they want based on the activity and play any role they want. So it's a sort of a difference between user groups and individuals that use the application. User groups are slightly different, and I think there's a few examples. James Surowiecki in Wisdom of Crowds talks about the four conditions that you need to have self-organizing groups. So diversity of opinion, right? Decentralization, independence, and aggregation, they all come in together. And I think that there's an example here is some of the traffic circles. I forget exactly where this one is. But the idea is that you put in place rules for behavior, and everyone sort of agrees to participate, and you don't need the formal structure of an organization defining how you work within the organization. Everyone can come in, and you notice there's no street signs, there's no, you know, who has the right of way, when you go, they all sort of depend on the individual interactions. And there's a lot of things happening here. There's the continuous and rapid feedback, obviously. And this guy just took on the truck and seemed to be okay. We hear a lot about collaboration and in agile methods, and it's often confused with consensus. And I want to be clear. I want to highlight that they're not the same. And so Wisdom of Crowds is often interpreted as we're all going to get together and come up with an idea. Well, that's consensus. Versus the wisdom of a bunch of individuals. And that goes back to monitoring your stakeholders and monitoring your users and being able, as they act independently, to identify patterns that help you make decisions, as opposed to let's all get together and come up with a sort of vanilla decision that everybody can tolerate. And finally, there's openness and transparency. I think there's a key differentiation between these two as well. Transparency is, from an agile perspective, is an organization's willingness to tell you what they're doing, why they're doing it, and how they're doing it. And that's important because if you're looking into it from outside that organization, you're going to want to understand, does the project align with our institution? What's it going to take to work with that group? What's their roadmap? What are they doing? How are they doing? You know, there's all sorts of reasons that you'll want to understand that group. But openness is extending that and saying, I'm going to put the decision-making, or the organization saying, we're going to put the decision-making into the hands of the community. So here in the little example is the transparency allows me to see the path ahead, but the community, we might go either path, and we're going to use these principles to be able to define that direction. All right, so that was real quick on the principles behind agile methods. So Dave is going to talk. Oh, I'm going to drive for you. That's right.
You're driving.
I don't know of anyone better than Pat that I've found who's been able to explain for me concisely what's meant by agile principles, but also to try to understand the implications of agile thinking and agile methods for the way that we organize all sorts of projects, and not just simply software development projects, which is really what we're trying to explore here today. If you've not seen it already, I wanted to draw to your attention a recent book by Caroline Wagner, who's talked about the structure of science, the activity of science in a global context today. And she argues that there's something really quite striking going on in the way that science is organized and managed today. And we're talking about all kinds, physics, biochemistry, all kinds of scientific endeavors. That they're, first of all, global networks. And that should come as no surprise. We live in a sort of a network kind of culture. But what's particularly interesting is not just simply that they're networks, not just simply that they're global, but what's happening in science is that many of these are self-organizing networks. You can read the quote up there. They span the globe. They're self-organizing. They constitute what she calls an invisible college, right? And the reason she says this is that what's happening is that the work that's going on among scientists isn't happening necessarily at a university. It's not just simply scientists that are working together at the same physical location. But these are scientists that are collaborating over networks across global networks. And that work is being self-organized, right? It says here they're doing this not because they're told to, because they want to. They work together not because they share a laboratory or even a discipline, but because they can offer each other complementary insight, knowledge, or skills. What's really striking about the way in which science is being organized today, and the reason that she wrote the book, was to talk about the policy implications. It's not that the NSF is sort of driving the science or that national science foundations of any type are driving this. This is a global network that's working sort of outside those traditional ways to fund and manage big science projects. What she argues is that science is moving from a nationally based big science paradigm to this global network where global science is organized as a complex adaptive system. And what I'd like to suggest is that the way in which science is being organized looks very much like the agile principles that Pat just described and that Ken is going to build for us a little bit later on. In other words, as a complex adaptive system, global science has many differing interactive elements here being scientists. They respond to shifts in the environment, that is to say, the investigative environment, the funding environment, but they're able to move quickly and with great agility. Participants in this global, new, invisible college enter and exit as they wish, but the whole retains its structure, another defining characteristic of a complex adaptive system. It's self-organizing. There is no central administration to this global network of scientists. There's not a president of the new invisible college. There's not a provost. It's a self-organizing system. A lot of the activities, many of the activities, are emergent and unplanned. And the network is scale-free. In other words, you see the same kind of organization at whatever scale you might be operating. This is the way in which global science is operating. Science, of course, is a knowledge-intensive industry. And what I'd like to suggest is that what we're seeing here in the emergence of global science as a complex adaptive system is a metaphor for how we might think about that other great institution of knowledge, universities, the way we think about the organization of universities. So if agile principles, and I'd like to sort of build off on what Pat was just suggesting, if agile principles best coordinate and guide networks and complex adaptive systems, like the one we just saw, if it's agile principles that work best, then the university, as a system of knowledge, is also a complex adaptive system. However, we manage universities today as if they were hierarchical industrial organizations. Therefore, I'd like to suggest in this syllogism, is this system incompatible with the realities of a network society? Are we running our universities in ways that are incompatible with the rest of the network society that we find ourselves living in? These are different kinds of networks. These are different kinds of complex adaptive systems. I call them all platforms, and we all know what a platform means, of course, in a software sense. But to me, a platform is a kind of organization, a space that allows these kinds of emergent, self-organizing, unplanned activities to occur. I would say all take place in the context of a platform. The biggest one, the one before that, Pat. Go to the one before. Wow. It was doing this last night as well. The one platform that we all recognize, of course, is Wikipedia. It's probably the most visible, most popular sort of platform, Flickr. In other words, Wikipedia, and we know how the articles were created on Wikipedia, right? They weren't planned by an editorial staff. They didn't lay out a headword list, as is typical with Encyclopedia. Almost 3 million articles in English were decided by the participants as they write the articles. Flickr works the same way. But I don't think that platforms have to necessarily be technological in that sense. They can also be in the physical world as well. And so the example I like to point to is like the medieval fair, for example, or a bazaar. Both of these are platforms, right? They allow certain types of activities, unplanned activities, to occur. Gardner Campbell, I rely on this example that he gives about a sandbox, obviously. We know what a sandbox is in software development terms. But again, you don't go into a sandbox as a kid with preset ideas about how to play in that sandbox, right? Kids go, they find toys, they dream up different ideas, and there's new kinds of activities that occur every time you go into a sandbox. This is an example of a classroom, and a constructivist classroom. And maybe if you've taught in sort of a constructivist setting where the teacher or the professor isn't the sage on the stage but rather the guide on the side. To me, that kind of classroom operates in this kind of platform, agile-like manner, right? The learning occurs in many ways in a kind of emergent or self-organizing sort of manner. Open access or open space technology or an unconference would be another such example. Classical Athens. All of these are examples of platforms, all of which, if we were to dig further, I would suggest probably have agile principles running each one of them. This has been very much, and Pat was suggesting titles some books. We've been seeing other books that talk about these kinds of principles, right? Clay Shirky. Here comes everybody, right? The power of organizing without organizations. The spider and the starfish makes very similar kinds of claims about these new kinds of organizations. They're decentralized organizations, right? Where no one is in charge, there's no headquarters. Knowledge and power are distributed. So what if we started thinking about universities in the same way? What if we started thinking about universities as like networks or as complex adaptive systems or indeed as like a platform? What might that look like? About 2 years ago, I ran a focus group with a group of educators and asked them this question. What if we ran the university like Wikipedia? What if we ran it according to agile principles? And these are some of the responses that they came up with. First of all, there wouldn't be any formal admissions process. It'd be permeable. People could enter and exit as they wish. It would consist of voluntary and self-organizing associations of teachers and students, not unlike the original idea for the university in the Middle Ages. The curriculum itself would be self-organizing and intellectually fluid. Instead of waiting, in some cases like at Ohio State, for about 2 years to get a new course approval, a course could be approved just simply because we're going to teach a course. And you teach the course for as long as there seems to be interest in it, and then you stop teaching it when there doesn't seem to be interest in it.
I lost again.
the one before that, and we could talk about, boy, wow. The curriculum would be intellectually fluid. This would be a self-organizing and intellectually fluid curriculum. Okay, next one then. This was a big controversial one. The people in the focus group said you wouldn't have tenure, because tenure wouldn't make sense in such an agile system. Instead, you'd have professors whose longevity would be determined by the community, but who would also sort of move fluidly between the so-called real world and the university. And again, keeping with this notion of permeable boundaries, not separating the two. Such a university wouldn't be governed by administrative fiat. It wouldn't be, you know, by provosts and presidents. Sorry. It wouldn't be run by provosts and presidents. But it would be on the basis of community values. Principles, protocols, whatever term you want to use for those. Go ahead, Pat. Another maybe semi-controversial one. Such an agile university wouldn't necessarily grant degrees, but maybe certificates, for instance. And this is a trend we've been watching. More and more stackable certificates strikes me would be an important part of this university as platform. Such an open university would necessarily encourage play, but also encourage failure as well. as a way to try new ideas. And since we're talking about new ideas, it would be governed by things like intellectual barter. In other words, the knowledge and information that's created in such a university's platform would be open and free, not just simply to everybody at the university, but open to anybody else who would want to have access to it. And such a university's platform would have a fluid temporal structure, no semesters as such, teaching and learning as ongoing activities. I just read in, I think it was the Chronicle, just before I left for Anaheim, that there's a community college in Kentucky that's doing exactly this. You can take the class at any time. Start it tomorrow if you want. Work at it at your own pace. The fellow's teaching 400 or so students, not all at the same time. They're all working at very different levels, very different paces. Paul Goodman said in 1962 that, at the time, the almost 2,000 colleges and universities are the only, going back to the Middle Ages, the only important face-to-face self-governing communities still left in modern society. Self-regulating, self-governing. So my question is, what if we organized universities according to these agile platform-like principles, allowing the university to perform like the complex adaptive system I think it already is? And in fact, Ken is going to talk about ways in which a lot of these principles are being put into practice today with UMass Online. This is not just pie in the sky. This is actually very implementable, I think. Thanks.
Thank you, David. I guess I want to start by saying that it might be a little bit of an exaggeration to actually say that we're applying everything that we've been talking about so far. But we have been asking the fundamental questions, and I'll start by mentioning that I've been serving as the CEO of UMass Online for about a year, and it takes about that long to get a feel for things. Pat joined the team back around, 6 months ago now? Yeah? So, and it's been very, very helpful working with someone and having someone join the team who's had some experience with applying agile principles in part of an organization. And the question that we really have is how far can we extend these principles into other parts of the organization outside of just the technology groups? And that's what we've been really trying to do. I'll mention it. I don't think Vince is in here right now, but I sort of teased a quote out of him back about a week ago when I bumped into him and heard him talking about this. And Vince is with Qatar, and he's also the CIO of Kentucky University, or the University of Kentucky. And he basically claims that he can't think of a better way to solve or address complex social problems than with these principles of agility. Hopefully this won't jump all over the place. I will start by providing just a very, very, very brief description. And I'm going to try to keep this to around 10-12 minutes so we have a little bit of time to talk about some of the ideas that we've been presenting. But that, UMass Online was created relatively recently. It was created by the Board of Trustees, so it's an administrative structure. It's situated in a central office, which is the president's office. The University of Massachusetts is actually five universities each, so we've got five, faculty senates and academic authority resides in them. We've got, I think that we've got five campuses and four collective bargaining agreements for faculty, and then, of course, a host of others for administrators and so on. Basically what UMass Online does is it delivers services supporting online learning. And it's a suite of services that it does. And we have a revenue model in which we don't actually get appropriation from the state. We work in concert with the academic units, the campuses, to be able to generate revenue. And part of that revenue is an assessment that's used for operating UMass Online. When I first came in, of course, you look at a complex organization and you spend a little time thinking about it and so on. And what became obvious after a short period of time is that there was insufficient evidence of. And these particular areas, there was what I found to be insufficient evidence, and Pat helped verify some of that. And I'm choosing these terms very carefully because I'm not suggesting they didn't happen. It's just that there wasn't evidence of them happening. So there wasn't evidence of much documented process, and there wasn't much evidence of the rationale that supported decisions and the process that supported decisions. There wasn't much evidence of a strong culture of collaboration or of a strong culture of trust. Not so much internally, but whenever you haven't, we all have probably belonged to or been parts of systems, and that there is this sort of inherent trust issue between central sort of central units and distributed units, and even if you're in a distributed environment, how those distributed institutions relate to each other. And, you know, we had spent some time at SUNY, the State University of New York, where there's 64 sort of independent campuses of various types. And this is a pattern that I had seen elsewhere, and I think Pat might also agree with that, or he might not, but I think he does. And a very little evidence also of processes with that involve transparency. And there was strong evidence of other things. There was a very strong evidence of an inward focus. That is, we talked a lot about amongst ourselves and even the subgroups inside of UMass Online, but we didn't reach out in a lot of ways, including reaching out for benchmarking and other types of things. That is, there wasn't evidence of this. There was a strong UMass identity, which I think sort of also, which is sort of consistent with a lot of things that we're talking about. There was asymmetrical development of capacity in the different units in UMass Online. We have a technology unit, we do business development, we do brand development, marketing, and that type of thing. And there was probably a stronger reputation outside of the unit, outside of UMass Online, than there was sort of inside, which I think is sort of typical as well. And I think that there are cliches or there are sayings that sort of express that with all sorts of institutions. Now, I want to say that we started with taking a particular approach to agility or to introducing agile principles. And, you know, what we wanted to do was help develop basic capacity to be able to not only understand but articulate these basic principles. And it's sort of the understanding of our current practice, what we currently do, implementing an enabling infrastructure that is, you know, we need more than, it's not just a technology infrastructure. You have to have a way of being able to understand your current practice for all sorts of reasons. And we have to be able to engage in an educational process, internal and external, to be able to help people understand what we currently do, what we would like to do, and that type of thing. And this happens over and over and over again. It's basically an iterative process. What are we? What are we? What do we need to learn? And what tools do we need? Processes, cultural artifacts, do we need to be able to work this cycle to be able to better understand what we do and to be able to better leverage other parts of and grow as an organization? And, you know, the things that we're trying to implement, and this is important, is that it's just a ton of small decisions. You know, every time we make a decision as a group, we ask ourselves, are we being honest? Are we exercising humility? Is the decision that we're going to make promoting or sort of are not promoting transparency? Are we allowing for ideas to emerge? Are we allowing for practice to emerge? And this is a major issue because, you know, when you come into an organization, you start asking questions and you start trying to understand. Everyone has a sort of their own agenda, and everyone wants to be recognized for the good work that they've done. And it's very, very hard for people to exercise at first anyway. The humility is saying, yeah, you know what? It isn't perfect, probably hasn't ever been perfect, and I'm part of that. So, you know, these are the types of things that we're trying to do continuously. Now, what I think that we're really engaged in while trying to understand ourselves is an emergent pedagogy. That is, learning about yourselves is a learning process. And what we're really doing is saying, well, let's develop a way of learning about ourselves, which is a pedagogy or maybe even a curriculum, and let's develop tools to help us support that, which is the idea of developing agile teaching or learning tools. So that's really how we're looking at the organization and how we're approaching organizational change and development. Now, I'm not going to go through every single example that I've got in here, but I do want to talk about a few in particular. We'll probably run through the first few and how we're looking at this. The examples, though, that I'm going to put on the table, and there are a whole lot of others, really coalesce around organizational behavior. How do we address issues around organizational behavior with principles of agility? How do we also sort of rationally do iterative prioritization of investment? That is, how do we decide what we're going to do with the resources that we have? And then also, how do we enhance openness and transparency within the organization? I'm going to provide a few examples of each and what we're trying to do or what we are doing with them. And around organizational behavior, One of the things that we're doing, and this is really basic, is the adoption and use of a wiki environment. And, you know, I know that this sounds a little bit, it might be a little bit of a tired discussion. I'm not going to go and drill into it very far. But what I am doing is basically saying that based upon the maturity model that was discussed a little bit beforehand, these are the types of things that we're trying to develop a platform for and to support values. And I'm not going to go through these, obviously, but values of courage and participation, principles of communication, transparency, et cetera, the practices of using Web 2.0 tools and that reinforce decentralization. I'm not going to go through all of these for each of them, obviously, but I will talk a little bit about what's happened with our wiki space as a platform for helping us understand ourselves and helping us develop with some agility. The platform, the wiki was basically introduced back in, and it's Confluence, so I may occasionally mention Confluence as sort of the wiki, but that's what it is. Is that back in at the first of the year, you can see the level of views that we were getting from the pages that we were developing and the resources that we were creating. And what you see is for the next 5 months, pretty static, sort of. I got to that level and it was kind of cruising along. I'll mention too that UMass Online is only 12 individuals. There's 12 professional staff members that are part of the team. So it's not an enormous organization. But you'll see in July that there's all of a sudden this, after that, there's this increase. And that's when actually Pat's team, the tech team, opened up the parts of the wiki that that were supporting that part of the organization. And what we see, of course, is this enormous growth in total views. And so the monthly views grew from, you know, under 5,000 or hovering around 5,000 up to about 45,000 this past month. So so we can see that there's adoption and interest. What we can also see, though, is not only the people viewing it out of curiosity, but they're actively engaging. And we can see the same sort of pattern happening here in that we see growth around that, which is good. And what that does is we're trying to create a platform. For instance, if you start editing, then you're actually exercising some courage. You're basically saying, I'm going to put some stuff out there that not everyone's necessarily going to agree with, or I have to make a stand on, or I'm providing an opinion on, and I'm exercising some courage. And at first it might be in small steps, but we're seeing patterns in which people are actually engaging in communities and or community discussions that are not flame wars, but certainly have some that exhibit a level of investment that we hadn't seen previously. And then I'll finally mention that, you know, here's a little bit of a graphic that suggests that it is expanding beyond our really local and small community. You'll see that the little blue sliver in there are the number of UMass Online staff members, and there's 12 of us. And then we have about 148 registered users, people who actually have been assigned roles and are part of groups that we support. And then you see the largest part of this, obviously, is the amount of visitors. And we had 3,000 unique visitors this past September. So what we're seeing is that that our ability to be able to behave in a transparent fashion is growing. So what we're talking about is just developing sort of a platform, but then a culture to support agility, or at least support the basic values of agility. What you have to get to before you see the more interesting things happening. I'd like to illustrate one other thing, and this has a little bit to do with the sort of collaboration thing and the enablement thing, is that what we had suggested was we're a little group. There's 12 people. We support 5 UMass campuses, and the first president's office, and then 10 other institutions that we support, 5 publics and 5 privates. And then we also play a role in the larger sector. And what we recognized is that we can't do this in a centralized fashion. That is, we have to look at all of the individuals who we work with and organizations as being basically a distributed, and I don't want to say staff, but resource. And we have to be able to work with those resources on terms that that are indicative of how you work in a distributed environment. It's very hard to do that if at a core level your values and practices aren't distributed. So we started really, really sort of promoting the idea of telecommuting, of getting out on campuses, getting out and behaving in a distributed fashion, which is one of the objectives and one of the practices that we're excited about. And we recognized, though, to be able to do this responsibly, we had to be able to adopt and use intelligently and cogently certain types of communication support tools. And so what we basically did was say, hey, here's a bunch of rules. In order to be able to support the agility that we want to be able to support, here are some rules about the types of tools that we're going to be using and our expectations for their use. And, you know, I don't want to go through these, but basically it wasn't a, you know, we didn't vote on them. We basically said, as an organization, for us to be comfortable with developing the capacity that we have to develop, is that we want these things to happen. And it's to be, and you know, and part of it, quite frankly, is we're a public university, and we are custodians of public funds. And if we're going to be doing things that are a little bit outside of how we normally behave within a centralized office, we want to be able to rationalize what we're doing, be accountable for the time that we spend, and so on and so forth. So these are the things, and it's actually hooked into the performance review process that we all go through. So it's hooked into some traditional processes as well. So I just wanted to kind of bring this up and as one of the things that we also are doing. Now, notice that none of these things are terribly exciting, but they're foundational. If you're not being able to do this, it's very hard to do other things. One of the things that I do want to bring up is that we recognize that it's more than virtual. There's a lot that's conveyed in physical space as well. And I'm going to just kind of step through this a little bit because I think it's very it's something that I've tried to achieve at Penn State. We tried to achieve at SUNY for various reasons, and we simply were not able to. And I'd like to just sort of flout this a little bit, is that, you know, we had the idea that open organizations behave in ways and configure themselves in ways that support creativity and innovation through transparency and openness. And part of that is being, is working in that environment. When you're not distributed and you're coming together, you don't want to be huddled away in a cube or a space or a closed office or whatever the case may be. So we're experimenting with some of what it would be like to be in an open space. And we've got sort of conceptual, the model should reinforce the benefits of distributed staff, as I had just mentioned. And as Pat likes to point out, everyone gets to be a pair programmer because you can't help but to do so. And in practice, what we basically did is we had some discussion around open office space that occurred and some of our needs. That is, we didn't bring it up until we needed to bring it up. We ended up having too many staff members for the amount of space. So it was sort of like, hey, we got an issue, let's deal with it. It's evidence-based. And that the transition occurred voluntarily. No one was forced to come along. Pat and I have discussed this at length, and this very much in part was Pat's approach to this. And in fact, we really felt as if at one point when we decided to do this open office thing, that it was going to be Pat and his next hire. So it'd be just Pat sitting in this large space. And it didn't really work out that way. We ended up getting a lot of volunteers interested in participating in this experience. Now, this is not the open office space. This is our cube space, and you'll see that it's actually pretty nice. I mean, by and large, this is kind of nice cube space, but you can see, and you can imagine how we work together in these spaces. Not really. What we ended up with, though, is this. We ended up taking over about a quarter of the office space, and this became the area in which the tech team is principally working. The data, our analyst will be working in there as well, and we also have a staff member who's more administrative. But you can see that what we have is nice open access to the windows. We've got something here that's and Pat can point this out because I do hover. I hear stuff going on out there, and I'm like, oh, that sounds too cool. I come out of my office space, which is a private office space, and hover a boy by the by this area right here, and wish that I was in the more was engaged in more interesting conversation. But you'll notice here that all of these chairs, of course, swivel, and they continuously have. I mean, Pat can testify to this. They continuously have discussions across the table in impromptu fashions, and in addition, when Pat picks up the phone and is talking to somebody, on a campus, is that everyone on his team knows exactly what he's talking about. So there's honesty, there's candor, there's all of those sorts of things that are part of the value system that we're trying to create. Now, I'm going to also mention, too, that, I mean, Pat's mentioned this, or he's mentioned it, is that people from all over the president's office come over and like, what's this about? This is very, very different than what you've been doing. And so it's influencing discussion across the president's office, and to the point where we basically said, here, go to Confluence. You can see what this is about. Ask questions, whatever the case may be. And then finally, I just wanted to mention that, you know, and Pat never says get back to work. And I think that Pat's shaking his head. He didn't really want this in here. I stuffed it in here. But what this does is that just 6 months ago, a year ago, when I first came in here, doing something, this was his staff who did this, doing something like this would have been next to blasphemy in the president's office. You just did not poke fun or anything at people in other parts of the hierarchy in the organization. It was just taboo. And in just the past, what has it been, 4 weeks, 3 weeks that we've had this space, there has been an entire change in the amount of playfulness, actually, that is exhibited in that space. It's really, it far exceeds what I had expected. And it has actually extended beyond that, where because that's happening, everyone's guard has been let down. There's a lot more communication. There's a lot more authentic communication and honesty. You can really feel it. So in any event, but I do want to mention that Pat never says get back to work. I am going to actually turn over to Pat or let him just talk a little bit about this. We're also engaging in something that's an iterative prioritization process. And this really points to a number of the principles of agility that Pat will probably poke at. There's something that's called Nifty. We also call it the volcano. You see why in a minute. But it's a way of being able to do things that are based upon, adopt new projects that are based upon emergence, evidence of need, iterative development, all of these sorts of things. And you can see them in here. Here's a diagram of it. And Pat, would you like to just, you got a live mic there, or you can talk from up here?
Sure. Just real quick, we don't have a lot of time. So this is basically a diagram that we talked about introducing a needs identification and resourcing approach, which might normally be done through strategic planning that would take place within the organization or within a department, whatever it is. And the idea is to apply the agile principles that we've talked about in order to capture the areas of investment that we should be making in terms of deploying technology. You can use this for program development, academic program. I mean, so the bottom line here, if you look across the middle there, at the bottom, and you can see it's sort of a volcano, but the scope of services that are in demand or of interest, we should say, across the university represent the red line at the bottom. Oh, thanks. I got to stay on the mic, they said. And that's sort of the scope of the stakeholders that we have. The little ripple line there, the up and down, those are all sort of the percolating issues that everyone's talking about. So one peak might be your e-portfolio, one might be content management, one might be desktop sharing. You know, you have all these sort of areas of interest. The top circle there, at the very top, is actually our scope, our capacity. That's what we can actually deliver in production, right? So you can see that the desire, and I'm sure you all feel this, is the things people want are much more than what we can provide. So the question is how can we identify those activities, those area of interest that are actually have enough interest across the campus, are relevant, are something that we should be investing in, and isn't driven by a directive from the central office, isn't direct, somebody whose status is high on a campus or whatever politically savvy group that comes in and makes us do something. So the idea is to, first of all, offer service levels at the same offer service at the same levels that the user community is working at. So the idea is if you have an idea, if you call up the help desk and say, oh, I'd like to do this, and the help desk says, well, we don't do that. Well, I need this for my course. Well, what we'll do is say, oh, fine, we'll give you a page in the wiki. All right, and you can describe in a white paper if you want, describe what this is. And this is open to everyone, and the next time we get a call, we'll point somebody to what this project is, and now you've got two people are interested. So the idea is that people begin to self-organize based on their local needs. I need this for my class. Here's a resource where I can find like-minded individuals that we can organize around. And as interest grows, you get more people participating in the wiki in terms of describing the service, describing your issue and how it relates. You might find out, well, that's not what I'm interested in. You might go somewhere else. Or you might say, yeah, this is what I'm interested in. It'd be better if this. And a group begins to form about that. The next level is we begin to say, okay, you seem to have some interest. We're going to sponsor you and send you out to NERCOMP, which is the Northeast Regional. We're on the West Coast. Maybe people don't know what that is. But it's sort of like the EDUCAUSE regional thing. We'll send you there, and you can present this, and you can find more folks. And the idea is as more people come in and describe the issue, we begin to say, okay, we'll give you a non-production environment for your e-portfolio. We'll give you a non-production environment for your and that then informs the group. And what happens is the merit of that project attracts more folks, which helps us to better understand the project, which then leads us to a better implementation process, which at some point gets to the point where it moves into production. So we're constantly engaging in scope creep, but it's an informed scope creep based on the actual activity that's articulated by the user group. So that's what the pyramid is. And it encompasses a lot of the Agile principles.
So we're almost out of time. I'll just mention that we have some active projects. This has just started. So, you know, Enterprise Wiki's ePortfolios is a perfect example. We've got a few different projects that are going on, and it's because no one really agrees on exactly what the ePortfolio is. So you've got communities developing around student assessment or lifelong learning or whatever the case may be, and they are different in their different communities, and we'll support them at different levels depending upon the nature of that outcry or engagement. So those are some of the other things. I'm just going to we don't have time to go through these others. This material is available, but you know, one of the things that I will mention is that one of the things that we are doing is an open budgeting process in which the whole team actually is determining the priorities in which we're working from and discussing what they are and contributing to them in sort of an iterative environment, and that's where we kind of make our investments based upon sort of rationale around the organizational priorities, something that was an absolute black box before we started engaging in these types of processes. Last thing I will bring over, though, is just the overview, and you'll notice that, I mean, I know that this is a little confusing. Anything that is an A up there is basically saying we're actively doing it. Anything that is a P is that we are doing things to prepare to be able to support these objectives, principles, values, or what have you. And you will see, I'm probably a little bit optimistic, but what you see here is that earlier down in the in this part, that's earlier in the maturity section, is that you get a lot of preparation, and then when you get up to these sorts of things, these practices and objectives that are farther up into the maturity model, you see it drops off quite a bit. So what we're very much hoping, though, is that we're building some of the capacity and values and so on and so forth early at some of those easier things, you know, helping people exhibit courage and to support communication and to do some stuff at Web 2.0. And then hopefully it will support these really hard things that are hard for the organization and perhaps a little bit threatening. So hopefully over the course of the next year or so, we'll see a lot more happening at the higher maturity levels. So thank you very much.